shit show. It's a fucking shit show.
Welcome back to Shit Show Saturday. We have somebody that's long overdue. I just looked at the first time that I asked you to be on here, and it was November 8th, 2023.
That's recovery time frame, isn't it? So glad to be here. I was scared. But you know what? In recovery, we're scared shitless, but we do it and show up anyways.
Mm-hmm. All right, so song.
Song. I've thought about this for a long time, and it's by Cobra Starship, Hot Mess. That's just my absolute favorite, that every time I hear it, I'm like, that's my shit show song.
Okay, carbohydrate.
I was thinking about this, and my thing is like Triscuits. Like, I need a crunch with whatever I'm eating. So I'll eat whatever kind of food, and I'll need like a Triscuit or a Wheat Thin kind of thing to like eat and crunch. Or like, I have 20 bags of chips because I need like all the flavors.
Exactly. Okay, cheese.
Cheese, like those twisted cheese that are like string cheese, that's like mozzarella and cheddar.
Oh,
like
and the two different around. Colors?
Yeah, two different colors.
Okay, condiment.
Famously, I once said in high school, I'm anti-condimist, and I didn't realize that that means I'm against condoms and not condiments. But I'm not a huge condiment guy. I don't like ketchup or mayo or mustard. I always did like the plain hot dogs.
You have to use something at some point.
Like barbecue sauce.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. That'll work.
But you're anxious.
Yeah.
So you're an outlier. You don't follow the my theory as much about anxious loves condiments.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, so when did you realize that you were an adult child?
I started realizing it slowly. I started in the rooms of AA back in December of 2019, did that for 2 years, wound up into Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. That was in October of 2021. So I just hit my 3 years in that program. And then I just had my 1 year anniversary of coming to the shit show. And I probably a few months before that had been listening for a long time and was starting to piece together, because I got so hung up on the fact that my parents weren't alcoholics and the and dysfunction part. I'm like, no, that's not me. Because I would like, it took me, years of therapy for me even to say that my trauma was bad enough, that like my dysfunction was bad enough in my family, that I deserved to find healing, because I was just in such denial that I'm like, I can't do that. I can't talk bad about my parents. Like, I love them, and no, everything's fine. And having to break that denial to be like, no, this is reality. This is where we're at. And I got to get some help, because this is unmanageable as fuck. And wound up here.
When you first got sober, was it just like, I have a disease, you know?
Yeah, it was like that hard thing of being like, what is this a disease? Am I at fault for this? Like, what's wrong with me? Because again, in my family, like, there's some outliers here and there, the family members of alcoholics, but alcohol, just again, being raised super Christian, I didn't drink till I was 20, almost 21 actually, and had just never had a desire to do it until I did. And when I found that I could use it and it made the pain stop for a little bit, I was just like, balls to the wall, go for it. Started super drinking when I moved to North Dakota. I worked in the oil field in Williston, North Dakota, like during the oil boom of like 2013. And I put it together in therapy that I went up there, and my roommates were these dudes from Washington. We lived on the Montana border, like where the time zone change happens, like directly on the border. And there was like five of us in this house. Like, rent was hella expensive because it was such super boob town. There was like 40,000 men living in this town of like 12,000 people.
Did you say boob town?
Boomtown.
Oh, I thought you said boob.
Boobtown. No, they had a place called Boomtown Babes where girls would wear like lingerie and pour coffee, and they'd have a line of like 20 cars because all the men up there were so starved. Like, the strippers would make like $5,000 a weekend, and they'd fly them up from like Vegas. It was a crazy real life boomtown, like, you know, oil riggers and stuff like that. I worked for a chemical company and did like fracking and sold my soul to the devil for a little while. And made the best money I ever had, because before that, I ranched and was a cowboy because I was trying to be overly masculine to like compensate for the fact that I was trying to come out a little bit. But I put together that I started heavily drinking at the time that I started talking to guys online because I was trying to suppress so much my gayness. I'm like, it's okay that I'm struggling with same-sex attraction because I still believe that God didn't want me to. But when I drank, it was like in IFS, one of the parts of me came out that's like, oh, we can do this and we feel good. And it hit like the drinking helped the overall pain. And then it hit the validation points of like needing that external validation, like, oh my God, these boys on the internet care about me. And I'd fall in love with like Caleb in Alabama and plan our life together. I have a journal entry where I did. I was like, I don't want to say I'm in love, but I think I am, with a boy I'd met on the internet for like an hour. And it's cute, but also shows a lot of desperation that I just so desperately needed external validation. I had no idea how to do it for myself. So I would do that and I would drink and like chat on the internet and then take trips across the country to like Florida for a weekend and meet up with a guy and do all that stuff and then and come back. And it just always like tears in the airport, just cry, like sobbing and like drinking like a fish to like try and numb the pain. But I just had this dual life that I lived that was so painful. God, it was just so painful all the
Yeah.
time.
Well, it's kind of like how the no bad parts thing, because that part of you that wants to get intoxicated, that's rooted in that part wanting you to live as your authentic self.
Yeah, and just having no idea how to do it. And so I did that for a few years until I got my first DUI up there on my birthday, no less. Spent the night in jail, had some like meth addicts tell me happy birthday, which was like a whole thing in this super small town jail. But I got out of there, and that's when I moved back to Denver. And my parents are from Northern California. That's where I grew up. They moved up into the mountains of Colorado at the same time. So I moved down, they moved over. So I lived with them for a hot sec and was like trying to hide the drinking because I couldn't let them know. And they were like kind of okay with the DUI. They're like, we all make mistakes sometimes, as long as you learn to not drink as much. And I'm like, oh, I promise I'm not going to drink that much. Like hiding bottles of Jack Daniels under my like bed and throwing them out like late at night. So didn't work out. And I actually got kicked out of my mom's house, moved in with a friend down in Denver and started doing that, and then started like bartending and stuff. And that was just the life that I worked at a tequila bar. Like that's what you did. You do tastings every day and taste a couple gallons every day. And I was starting to realize I wasn't like other people, because that's when I started to come out into like the gay scene of like the party scene and like drug, sex, and rock and roll and circuit parties. And it was so great. And I got my first boyfriend that like was in person, and we were like a power couple and would like sleep around with everyone. And I would find myself like sneaking to steal his roommate's liquor, like bit by bit of different bottles, you know, so he couldn't tell. And that's maybe the first time I started to realize, I'm like, I had a boyfriend that I dated when I was 23. He was 36, which was my MO. I did that a lot, like multiple times, daddy issues all the way. But he's the first person that told me, he's like, I think you might have kind of a problem with drinking. I'm like, no, it's just North Dakota, that's what you do. And then it was like, it's just Denver, that's what you do. And like always an excuse, and starting to realize that it stopped being fun, and it got really sad and dark. And I was living alone, you know, jumping from boyfriend to boyfriend or fling to fling, and just drinking sad alone in my apartment on like in Capitol Hill of Denver, just like in a dark basement drinking, where like it wasn't drinking for funsies anymore. It was like just so much pain, and I couldn't handle it. My family didn't know what to do. And that's when I got my second DUI, which thank God for, because my folks stepped in and they're like, no, this is not okay. You're moving back in with us. And I did. And I stayed sober for a while, the most months I ever had. But I had to do a stint in Denver County Jail. So I did 30 days of outpatient, not outpatient, that's rehab, work release, where I could
Got it.
work. I got a job at Home Depot and did that for 30 days. And the way home from getting out of jail, I was like, this is my last chance before probation. I should just drink tonight, like one last time. And I did it. And then it became, well, I waited 2 months till the next time, and then it was 1 month, and then it was 2 weeks, and then it was every day again before I knew it. And it was just hiding it from my parents, and did that for as long as I could until I couldn't hide it anymore. It just was ruining my life, like 2017, 18. And then finally in 2019, they were gonna like kick me out again. I had no options, and like, you got to go to rehab, which we had like, no one in my family's gone to rehab. Like some families that happens all the time, but for us, it was like not a thing. So I like had to pick up the phone myself and call, and started that day. And that was December 10th, 2019. And it actually stuck. And it was like right before the pandemic. And so I figured that the big difference was getting into group therapy for my outpatient, of like finding other people to like be real with and honest for the first time. Cause I had like tried to do that in church, tried to do it in the gay world. I didn't fit anywhere. And it was finally at a place where I could like show up authentically and be seen and heard by other people. And that was the difference, like totally the difference.
So your awakening as far as your childhood trauma, like your very first fourth step in AA, what was your understanding of your parents?
The drinking was like so much more prevalent of what was ruining my life that I like saw it, but I didn't quite get it. And I needed to do that first of like see what I'd done externally to then start building inward. And that's why like AA was great and helped me out so much. But 2 years into it, I looked around and I'm like, my life is so unmanageable still. And that's when it hit me that I needed to go to Sex and Love Addicts. So like AA was the first step, like stop drinking, stop drugging. Second step of being my sex, love, fantasy, validation, intrigue, romance, all of those parts. So it was going from like substance addiction into.
To the relationships up.
Yeah.
How long had you been in slob before, like, they then realized the childhood stuff?
A year and a half,
And what
2 years.
was it?
It was the like bit of therapy helping me again realizing that my trauma is real, because I knew it was there, but I was so stuck in denial that that's when I started pulling those pieces apart to be like, oh, trauma is real. My trauma is real. I need to look at this. And it was so painful to look at, but I finally started doing it and seeing that I'm like, you know how it says like a blameless inventory of our parents in ACA. Like I first heard that and I was like, what the fuck do you mean? Like if I admit this is real, that's blaming them. I can't do that. I can't blame them. But I started to finally realize that like my pain was worth fighting for, like worth trying to not fix me, but to finally look at it long enough to be like, Mikey, my inner child, is worth fighting for. Because he's still here and he's been screaming, he's been panicked, he's been lost, and no one's taking care of him. My dad is great and phenomenal. He just has Asperger's, so like autism spectrum kind of stuff. So just very logical, very compartmentalized. Like I knew he loved me and he just didn't say it that much. So he tried his best. We did like Boy Scouts and stuff, and he really did his best, but I always heard it through my mom of saying, your father loves you so much. And I'm like, I know, but in that time is when I was like, I really just want to hear my dad say he's proud of me. And that's when my sponsor, Chris, for the first time, that the first time I shared my whole story at a meeting, like a full-on like 20, 30-minute share, afterwards is when he said like to the whole room of how proud he was of me. And it was the first time any like man that I looked up to said that about me. And it just like was a
It's so sweet.
crazy moment of finally hearing that. And we talked about that last night, and to see today how that was so impactful to me. But today I have learned that I don't need that. I'm able to do that for myself. I'm able to, because of the healing in ACA, I've been able to see that the trauma is real, but I don't have to stay stuck there. It doesn't have to run the show. Like Michael, my higher power, gets to run the show. And when I am scared and I am in that like adolescent, there's another podcast like called The Adult Chair, which is very similar to the idea of, seeing your adult chair.
I had her on.
Oh, that's right. Michelle Chalfant. Yeah, I remember I'd always listen to, I think I started with some of her stuff. And maybe that's how I like found my way into yours, of starting to hear of like, oh, there's a name for this, like adult children. And I got stuck on the fact that I'm like, my parents aren't alcoholics. That doesn't apply to me, until I started really hearing people talk about it, of like, this dysfunction is just so simple. And the first time I read the laundry list, just like a gut punch.
Shit your pants.
Do you shit shows ever feel like you're just too damn busy to eat healthy? So I used to feel this way. Every day I would wake up with the intention of eating clean, and before you know it, it's 10:30 p.m., I'm in my bed, and I'm eating smart food popcorn. That is, until I found the perfect solution. Meal kits from Sunbasket. No matter what your lifestyle is, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. Every single recipe is shit show proof, so pre-measured, pre-proportioned, easy to prepare. I'm most recently made the seared Alaskan halibut with mashed potatoes and herb brown butter parmesan sauce, and it was damn good. And for you shit shows out there who only know how to work a microwave, Sunbasket also has pre-made meals that are ready to eat in less than 5 minutes. No prep, no mess. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 off your first four deliveries. That is sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your very first order.
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway, night sweats, poor sleep, feeling tired all the time, bloating, gas, man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today. So paint the picture of what your childhood was like.
Yeah, I grew up in, don't be jealous, but I was born in Modesto, California. It's like the armpit of California. It's gross, in the Central Valley. But I grew up in this town called Santa Rosa, which is like wine country, redwood trees near the ocean, kind of. So great, amazing. And I was born into, again, the Evangelical Covenant Church, which I was all about. Again, I came out, not came out. I looked around as a child and I saw what the rules were. The unspoken rules about like church and stuff. And I was like, oh, that's what I need to do. And when I was about 8 years old is when I realized that like a lot of stuff changed. I have an older brother. His name's Big Steve, 5 years older than me, but he's mentally handicapped. And so at about 8 years old is when I realized I'm the older brother. And it kind of traded places with that, of realizing that he's super high functioning. He's still to this day, like, he holds a job. He can work. He worked at Home Depot and Tractor Supply, so he's functioning. He used to not be able to talk. He had a thing called global apraxia, and luckily, my mom and aunt were both speech pathologists. And in the 90s, they didn't know what autism was really, so they'd like fly him around to like New York to try and find these doctors to figure out like what was wrong, because it wasn't normal. But today, there's so much like awareness about it that it's so much great when you catch it. Can help. But so they were great. But that's when I realized, like, my family's got enough shit going on. They don't need to deal with me. And I knew my deep dark secret, like, being a gay kid is not okay in this. So
When
I
did you
will be
realize that you were gay?
super young, like, always known, but again, knew I needed to bury it deep inside, lock it behind layers of doors, because it's just thinkable because it didn't fit program. So I became super perfectionist, super great, president of the school, captain of the cross country team. I ran like the worship group. I played bass in the worship team. So I was a Jesus freak all the way. And I was all about it at the time, but also carried this deep, dark secret that I couldn't come out.
What was the energy like in your home? Did your parents fight a lot?
Yeah, they did fight a lot, which is very common for kids with a disabled child. And from a very young age, I realized that, like, I need to be a parent. And my parents would fight all the time because, again, my mom is very emotional and kind of crazy like that. My dad being more Asperger's, they just clash a lot. And so I learned to like triangulate and like make things okay, or like they got in a fight. So, hey, mom, I cleaned the house. And like, are you proud of me now? And she needs help and I need to do that. And so I would do that. I like stepped up and thought if I could be perfect enough, like it'll compensate for Steve. And that
What?
was so hard as a kid to do that, but know that it's just part of life, of that it's just what you got to do. And so I did it.
Was there verbal abuse or mostly just emotional?
Gosh. My thing with my mom that I love so much, it's just hard that she will say the right things. But then every, like the actions, everything behind it are the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So I learned to put myself second and forget about myself and just do whatever was needed so that she'd be okay. She wasn't okay because she and dad were fighting, or she and Steve were, he would have, explosions and stuff. So I just tried to be her best friend. And we always joked about that. And we were so super close, but I realize now like that was codependency,
Yeah.
not what I thought was love. So and I still know that she does love me to the moon and back. Love my parents, they love me. Learning today that that doesn't negate that it was still hard for me, and that Mikey did deserve a dad that said, "I love you and I'm proud of you all the time," or a mom that was able to be functioning enough that she was okay and that didn't happen, but that's okay. I don't have to stay stuck there. And I really like to, in therapy, and go back into those situations. And I believe that in doing like EMDR and IFS, like I can step into those shoes again, where Mikey is just like crying in a corner by himself, everything's falling apart. And I today, as Michael, can come and step in and say, "I got you, bud. You're all right. I love you so much. You're doing so, I'm so proud of you. Like you're doing it. And I'm so like, that's the kind of dad that I needed. And that's the kind of dad that I get to be when I'm in my Michael shoes. Like I get to do that and I get to heal and change that shitty, terrible, traumatic situation and heal it. And not just like a band-aid, like real healing." And we had a great sex and love addicts meeting last night, where yesterday's like daily meditation was on reality. I was so good because, as you know, I've been avoiding my mom a lot and just dealing with that of like, how do I do that? And it was her birthday on Monday. And so I knew I needed to call. And I was like having to work myself up for it. Like, okay, well, I do a thing with my avoidance where I tell myself, like, oh my God, that's super important. I should call her. How about like 10 a.m.? Like, that's a great time. And then 10 a.m. comes along. I'm like, well, I don't want to do it. I should do it at lunch. But lunchtime is better. And then lunchtime comes and it's like, well, I'd want to wait till the afternoon. It's like 3 o'clock. And then I had therapy and I'm like, I want to go to therapy and say, like, I did it. I took the step. I made it happen and I'm done with it. Didn't happen. So I just talked the whole time about me being indecisive and finally did it on my way to another gay AA meeting that night. And the first 15 minutes were great. It was like, hey, how are you? Happy birthday. How's the fam? All this stuff. And then she dropped the like, can we talk? And I'm like, ah, shit. So it went as well as it could have. But, a couple months ago, back in May, I had a big blowout where I said things that I needed to say for like 30 years. And I'm glad I did. And I'm really proud that I didn't walk it back. I didn't take it all back. I didn't apologize. I said, I'm like, I'm sorry if I came on super strong, but I was feeling a lot of feelings. And I was able to see that I'm like, my problem is I think that if only I can explain it, we'll see eye to eye and we'll be okay. And the reality that recovery teaches me is that she will never get this. And I need to be okay with that because it's wrecking my serenity to try and like make her okay. If she wants to choose to be okay, she's gonna need to do that. And left it as is, ended up going to a meeting and just like staring at the floor, and it's written all over my face. So my friends are like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I hate that alcoholism is a family disease, and my parents don't drink, but they choose God as their liquor, which is great, and I love them, and I love my dad's faith and my mom's. I'm so happy that that works for them. I'm just like learning that it doesn't work for me, and that's really hard to break that mold
Yeah.
when it's so ingrained in you from a young age, and when you do it for 20 years, it's gonna take some time to break out of it.
Is your brother still alive? What is his deal?
So he's back home, he lives with them. He works like 2 days a week. He's all about like video games and Netflix.
How autistic is he?
It's hard to like put a finger on. I say he's just like a big kid. He's not like some people are like savants where they like have a miracle memory, whatever, but he does. He'll just like remember movies from when we were like 10, and it seems like he can like watch them in his head and like entertain himself. But he's functioning, he's there. He didn't talk till he was like 8 years old. Now he won't shut the fuck
No.
up. Just talks and talks and talks about whatever he wants to talk about. But he's great. But realizing that I still have some healing to do there because it's still there. It's hard. I do have some resentments and stuff, but learning that admitting that isn't gonna kill me. Admitting that that reality, like that was hard to grow up with a brother like that. It's really hard that this is how the cards were dealt. But I don't have to sweep that under the rug. I don't have to hide that, but I also can just deal with it one day at a time, being like, all right, when I'm ready to tackle some EMDR and stuff, I'll be ready when I'm ready. It just might not be at this moment.
Do you feel like they were neglectful or abusive to him during childhood?
They were super focused on him, and that's where, again, it's hard for me to say that, like, they neglected me. They tried their damnedest, and they did a great job, and they did do a lot for me. That doesn't negate the fact that I did kind of feel second fiddle.
Of course. Do you remember learning your brother was like disabled in some way? Like your parents told you, or you had that realization?
Yeah, I specifically remember when I was about 8 years old, I was in my bedroom and Steve was freaking out about something, and I was freaking out too. And I was just screaming and just so mad. I'm just like, why can't you be normal? Like, why, mom? And she was hurting too. And she said, this is the way it is. And we need to deal with it. So get with it. I don't know if that's the exact words, but that's what I took from it of like, this is how it is. My feelings about it don't matter. So let's just move on from there. And that's as I so at a young age of that parentification of being like, I need to be an adult. And I did that. And it was always the old soul, you know, like that time, which just means tons of trauma. But
It's really a unique and interesting experience that you had of the whole like having a disabled or like a sick sibling and the
yeah.
parents having to put all their attention and time on that child.
It's still like one of the biggest things for me. Like, I did not expect to talk about my brother today. That is still an area for me.
I don't think you've ever shared about this, have you? What is that about?
Both of my therapists had said that, like, I for a long time didn't. And that's where it's like showing that it's a real trauma response of hiding it because part of me feels like I didn't get a normal sibling. And I don't want to feel that way. I don't want that to be true. That makes me feel like a bad person because, you know, so many people that have handicapped people are like, oh my God, I just love them so much and I want to work with them and this and that. And I'm not that way. I don't like it. I want to distance myself from it because it hurts. It hurts to see that and like seeing other people around it. It just brings up so many memories and stuff that it's painful. And I still am trying to like realize how to process that because I don't know how to process it. I still don't. I don't know like quote unquote the answer or what is healthy with it. I don't know. But it hurts because I'm not a great brother. Again, I distance myself to protect myself, which feels shitty to not have that.
It's not your responsibility, you know? Like, that's just
And
it too.
that's where I mean adult
Yeah.
child of
That's, I mean,
like
it's the
feeling
same
like
thing
it
with
is my
me.
responsibility.
It's like, it's no different. It's all, essentially the same thing as like my dad going out of town and leaving, like, you know, having to take care of my drunk mom. It's kind of the same thing. And that, like, he wasn't your responsibility then, and he's not your fucking responsibility now. So is it the fear or the thought that somehow if you say that you had a disabled sibling that resulted in you being neglected, that you're afraid, or you think it seems like you're coming across as a selfish asshole because of that, essentially is what it is.
Yeah, but I'm starting to challenge those core narratives and beliefs that it's not true. It's just so hard, like specifically with this. I've done so much work with internal relationships, with part romantic partners, with my parents and all that, and it feels like one of the last like really big things that I like don't want to tackle because it just seems too big. It seems like how can I make sense of this? And I don't know if there is a way to like fully make sense of it. It's just how do I validate those feelings of the little kid and make him feel seen and heard? Because I don't right now. I want to hide it. I want to avoid it. I want to distance myself from it because that little kid's afraid that it's a reflection of him. Like somehow it's my fault that this is like this. Just like being a guilt sponge for everything. Logically, it makes no sense that that would be the case, but that feeling came up for me of just like, if I could just be perfect enough and get good grades and be the best Christian and be all of these things, like maybe the family will be okay. Just that peacemaker on the Enneagram, I'm a type 9, totally like the peacemaker of just if I can keep everything around me okay at all times, I'll be okay, you'll be okay, great. Don't rock the boat, don't make waves. And I've had to learn in recovery like that making those waves is how we move and how we grow and move past it, because if not, we stay stuck when we're trying to be that perfect at peace.
The whole thing of like, it's too scary for a kid to think that their parent is the problem. So they think that what's going on in the house is because of them. But like, what a kid also thinks that what's wrong with their sibling is also because there's something wrong with us too. You know, it's interesting.
Right? Like if I could be different enough, perfect enough, it would be okay.
Where do you think this is showing up?
God, I totally see it. Like I said, with the avoidance, the just if I see something scary or too big that I can't tackle, I need to push away from it, avoid it, hide it, or say, oh, that's totally important. I really want to do that, and then proceed to avoid it. And it happens where like, you know, I was like avoiding calling my mom and then so avoiding calling my sponsor and then like any of my friends, and it just builds and I build that shit pile where I want to say everything's going wrong when then I did it and made the phone call this week, and it was hard and it went as well as it could have, partially good, partially bad, but doing that, taking that actionable step, which is what recovery taught me of like when I wish things were different, you're going to stay wishing for a long time. But when you take action and do contrary action of like doing the scary thing, and that's where like right now of thinking about this idea of like going back to school, of wanting to explore that more and be, I don't know exactly, but something in the world of like psychology, therapy, that kind of world of helping people, like the core thing I found that what I want is to be the man that I didn't have when I was growing up for other younger gay men. and to be able to be that example and to show that this is hard and it sucks and it's real, but that we can move through it. Like there is healing. Like that is my, like when I get fired up, that's what I want to do. I don't want to have kids. I want to help kids all over the place. I want to have an impact on that. And how I do that, I think, is it starts with, you know, starting to go back to school, which then starts with figuring out where to go and then figuring out money, which leads to my debt, and which leads to, like, just recently heard about like Debtors Anonymous, and I'm like, I can't do it. I can't do another program.
It's
It's
really,
too many. I
it's
can't, and
that one's really
I
hard,
need
let me
to.
tell you. I've tried a couple times. It's really hard.
Yeah. Again, looking at my life and all the things that I've like tackled one at a time, like the drinking and the sex and the love and the starting to with the family, like this feels like one of the big last turned over stone, like needing to like look at it really. And I've just always like hidden it behind my back and being afraid to look at it. But the kid is afraid of that, but I'm not just that kid anymore. And I'm not alone doing this. I've got a whole shit show family of people. I've got people in person on Zoom all over the place that know and can understand and feel. And it just blows my mind to think that it would matter to other people. Because in my mind, it's so unhealthy and dysfunctional still for me that I shouldn't share it because.
Well, first of all, like you've only been doing this for like a little over a year, you know, like I'm 7 years and I'm still fucking trying to like work through the money stuff. Like this takes so long.
But remembering when I first came in, I couldn't imagine what it would be like to not drink every day. I had no concept, no clue whatsoever. And it was true that I could do it. And in the same way with the relationships and all these things, like I didn't know. And today I can say I don't know about my brother and stuff around that, but that's okay. I can trust and believe that I don't know what the healing is or how it happens, but I know I can make a choice to go into it.
It's almost like we don't really have much control in the matter. It's like the subconscious knows when we're ready to deal with it. I feel like when we're re ready to deal with it, it's like there's no other option but to deal with it.
Yeah, and this last year, actually, it was the first time I came to terms with the fact that I needed to get a diagnosis for ADHD because it was wrecking my life. I could not, for the life of me, be on time or remember stuff or keep up with. I just impossible. And working with a psychiatrist to handle that, and it's not like my medication's been a magic bullet, but it's so night and day different. Like,
That's
I'm
awesome.
on time. I'm early to work every day. I work overtime and I remember things, not perfectly, but I've learned ways of how do I, you know, I put like five alarms on my phone for talking tonight because I'm like, that's what I need to do because even I'm like, this is so important. I gotta do it. I gotta do it.
Gotta
And then
be
that
there.
was still just flip my mind. And that used to be my every day. And now so much more of the time I'm able to just handle what before I thought I couldn't handle. Like it's within my grasp. I'm able to tap into that executive function, which seems that old narrative is like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't. I've been avoiding doing my taxes for a long time. And I'm finally now. There's a guy here that works here that he like is a tax guy. And he's like, oh yeah, I can help you out with that. That'll be great to get that off your mind. And I'm like, why don't I do that? And to know that I am able to, it is within my power to just take that first step, not knowing the outcome, not doing it, just taking the action, the contraction. I'm scared of this. You know what? So what? I'm doing it and then doing it. And I did that, you know, just this week with calling my mom that it seemed in my head such a mountain that I couldn't overcome. And I did it. I did it. Like we do it. And I see other people in the group doing it. And that shows me, I'm like, wait, they did it. I did it. We can do this. I can do the
Set
next
of
thing that I
goals.
don't understand.
All right, so give me three things you like about yourself.
Ooh, that question would throw me for a loop before, but I am happy to say that I can answer it today, that I am proud of myself for being passionate. Proud of myself for being compassionate and proud of myself for being authentic, which all of those things,
Okay, hope or dream for the future.
hope or dream for the future, that I continue to take steps towards finding my purpose.
Ooh, you will. It's happening. It's unfolding.
Yeah.
Well, you are a very valuable member of the community, and we are so grateful and lucky to have you here. I know that other people feel the exact same.
Let it all go. What's making you slow now? Tell me.